Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for April 2019. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. New industries breed new areas of litigation. According to a survey done by the law firm Perkins Coie, the augmented and virtual reality industry segment is ripe for and vulnerable to patent litigation, particularly that brought by non-practicing entities or NPEs. In a paper entitled The Coming Wave, Preparing for the Rise of Patent Litigation in the Augmented and Virtual Reality Sector, the authors explain why this industry sector is exposed, how the case law is likely to evolve, and how businesses in the sector can best deal with the threat. In this podcast, I talk with two of the authors of that paper, David Bekaric-Crone and Daniel Grant Kane. David is counsel in the Madison, Wisconsin office of Perkins Coie. He worked in the software industry before becoming an attorney and has litigated patent cases in areas that include cloud computing, streaming media, email technology, and video game systems. Danielle is an associate in the Chicago office of Perkins Coie. In addition to her patent litigation practice, Danielle assists emerging and established companies with the legal considerations relating to launching new products, applications, and services. I spoke with Dave and Danielle from their respective offices in Madison and Chicago. Hello, Danielle. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the thesis of your paper is that there will be more patent litigation on the horizon for augmented and virtual reality businesses. So why is this sector in particular going to be prone to that?
So I think that what's happening is AR and VR technologies are becoming more mature. They're really reaching consumers. So developers of both software and hardware are sort of coming out of the garage. You can see this with augmented reality applications on smartphones, as well as new and cheaper virtual reality headsets that are coming out. In addition, there's a lot of technologies becoming more standardized, so people are developing VR apps using common libraries, and same thing with AR. And so if you're using standard technology, it makes it a little bit more prone to NPE suits, because those NPEs can sort of, you know, target the same technology but accuse a number of defendants of infringement, because the infringement would be the same for a number of defendants.
So what kind of companies are typical targets for NPEs?
So what we looked at in this paper, I mean, generally NPEs will target anybody, and there are definitely NPEs who have one or two patents and they will go after, you know, one or two specific targets. But what we looked at in this paper are places where NPEs had gone after sort of whole industries who were using sort of platform technologies, so they could go after a wide variety of targets using, you know, a small set of patents. And so what we looked at are one set of cases that were against targets who were using cloud computing technology, and then another set that were using basically web security technology, which was basically, you know, the whole internet to some degree. In addition, you know, NPEs generally want a settlement. They don't really want to go all the way with litigation most of the time, and so they may target companies they think that are willing to, you know, either give a quick settlement or, you know, may not want to go the full distance with litigation.
So your paper gives some examples of the two areas that you mentioned. So let's start with the cloud computing cases. What happened there?
So what the NPE did was sue a bunch of companies who were all using the same cloud computing technology. In fact, it's open source technology, so anyone can go onto the internet and download the software. And that software provided a distributed file system, so it was used by a lot of companies and has continued to be used by a lot of companies for cloud computing. it's a pretty standard system. And some of these companies promote the fact that they're using this. They have white papers talking about how they're using this open source software, and that makes it a little bit easier sometimes for the NPE to sort of pick out who the targets are going to be. And that NPE, and NPE for the listeners who don't know, is non-practicing entity. Another term that's often used is patent assertion entity. So these are companies that have patents but probably don't actually make any actual product, and so they generally are making their money off of litigation. So the NPE that sued all these cloud computing companies, they filed a little over 20 lawsuits, and where there are about 30 or so defendants. Those suits lasted about a year on average. The longest was 2.5 years, and pretty much all of those cases eventually settled. So even though they went for, you know, a significant amount of time, they didn't go all the way through trial or anything like that, and they all eventually settled with the NPE.
So what do you think are the lessons that could be learned from those cloud computing cases?
Well, so the defendants in those cases were not just the companies that developed the cloud computing technology. While some of them may have contributed to the open source software, some of them were just users of cloud computing technology. So they were, you know, one or two companies removed from the technology itself. And so one thing to note is you don't have to be an innovator to be sued. So in the AR, VR world, you don't have to be the one getting into all the 3D graphics and the math and all that kind of stuff, or being a hardware developer. If an NPE can find a patent that they think covers the technology generally, they may sue a retailer who happens to have an AR app, or someone who makes a VR experience for, you know, as a marketing tool or something like that. And so you really don't have to be an innovator to be sued. You can sort of be anywhere in the ecosystem.
And I think in your paper you mentioned that can include suppliers as well, right?
Sure. And so, you know, in the cloud computing cases, there were, you know, there were purveyors of the cloud computing technology who sort of, you know, had these services that people were purchasing. But there were also companies that were just using the cloud computing technology. And so the same thing would be true with AR and VR. It could be, you know, a retailer. It could be a marketing company that is making an app for another company. Or it could be the, you know, the company that is actually really doing the core technology.
So let's say that you're an augmented reality or virtual reality company, and you've been sued by an NPE. What are the best strategies to use?
Well, patent litigation is significantly more expensive than other types of litigation, since it's so specialized and technical, both in process and in substance. You know, you've got to worry about performing prior art searches, drafting and filing invalidity contentions. You've got expensive technical experts. So the longer into the lawsuit and the further into litigation that you proceed, the more it's going to cost you. So one strategy is to, you know, get your intel early and figure out who your opponent is so that you can start to weigh your settlement options, and then, you know, weigh your settlement options before the costs really start to rack up. And then on the flip side, if you are going to litigate, it would be beneficial for defendants to consider aggressively defending their case from the start. So that means, you know, gathering prior art and preparing a strong invalidity case. And then for certain kinds of software-related patents, you might even consider attacking the patent regarding whether they're even proper subject matter for a patent at all, with an early motion to dismiss.
So we're going to talk about summary dismissal motions later on in the podcast, but there's another group of cases that you discuss in your paper, and those are the security and Bluetooth cases. Could you tell us what happened there?
So those, unlike the cloud computing cases that targeted what seems relatively to be a small set of defendants, these cases, this NPE filed two waves of suits against a pretty large number of companies. So the patent is supposedly on a system for protected shareware, but the NPE initially sued companies that were using the Bluetooth 4.0 standard. And so wireless companies included some, you know, big names in the wireless world, including both developers of the wireless technology, developers of wireless hardware, so headsets, those sort of things, as well as retailers that were selling that hardware, because to be sued in the United States for patent infringement, you can be sued for making, using, selling, offering to sell, or importing infringing technology. So they had this first wave of suits where they accused Bluetooth of infringing their patent. And then a couple years ago, they brought a second wave of suits where they accused the security that controls a lot of the web security of infringing, and in particular, the S in HTTPS. They basically said that infringes their patent, and that is using what's called transport layer security, or TLS, and so they sued a number of companies arguing that basically their websites were infringing their patent. And so altogether, it was about 74 lawsuits in total.
So how were the web security and the Bluetooth cases resolved?
So unlike the cloud computing cases, which resolved, which took, you know, about a year for most of them to resolve, these cases went much quicker. The average case was about 102 days, so just over 3 months. And they filed against a larger number of defendants and settled them more quickly.
There were also some differences between the two waves of security cases in terms of how venue was handled under Section 1400B, and that's the patent venue statute. So during litigation, the T.C. Heartland and In re Cray decisions issued, and both of those cases significantly limited a plaintiff's ability to forum shop. So in T.C. Heartland, the Supreme Court held that a domestic corporation resides only in its state of incorporation for purposes of venue. And then in In re Cray, the Federal Circuit addressed the meaning of a defendant needing to have a regular and established place of business in order to establish venue. So now NPEs couldn't just file suit anywhere. And as a result, you'll see that in the first wave of security cases, these were largely brought in the Eastern District of Texas, which is known as a pro-patent venue, whereas the second wave of cases were brought all over the country, specifically where the defendants were located. So you'll see an influx of cases in places like Delaware, where a majority of companies are incorporated.
So what do you think of the lessons learned from the web security and Bluetooth cases?
Well, so I think that what it shows is there's the potential when something becomes really ubiquitous, like Bluetooth or TLS, which covers something like 80% of the web, that you can have this wide, very broad range of targets for an NPE. I also think that, you know, when you compare the two, the cloud computing and the security cases, trying to figure out what might happen for the AR and VR industry, I think that right now the AR and VR industry is probably, you know, it's less, AR and VR is less ubiquitous than, you know, web security. And so I think that probably the cases are going to look a little bit more like the cloud computing cases, probably not quite as many targets for an NPE. So there will probably be fewer defendants, sort of like the cloud computing cases, than the security cases. And with fewer defendants, they will probably be looking for a larger payout from each defendant. So they may take these cases a little bit farther into litigation than they might otherwise if there were more defendants. In addition, because of the Heartland and the Cray decisions, it's likely that they won't be clustered in the Eastern District of Texas as they would have been a couple years ago, but they may still try to bring suits in some sort of tech-heavy areas, so that we may see a lot of cases in the Northern District of California, for example, or the Western District of Washington, where Seattle's located. and those might be a way for NPEs to file a number of suits against defendants while still being able to basically use a very similar complaint against all of them. Eventually, when AR and VR becomes even more ubiquitous, there may be a second wave of suits that is really going after everybody in the same way that the security NPE went after basically every website on the internet.
So you mentioned earlier that the targets for NPE sometimes have certain characteristics. And one that you mentioned in your paper is the fact that they're companies that are averse to protracted public litigation. Can you give us some examples of those?
Well, so it's interesting. One of the cases we looked at was a case where there was an NPE who sued 10 companies in the District of New Jersey. All those companies were streaming media companies, but they were all streaming media companies that were adult entertainment website purveyors. And so it is possible that the plaintiff thought the defendants would be really averse to protracted litigation because of the industry they were in and might get quicker settlements or something like that. That's actually not what happened in that particular case, because they actually went and fought quite hard against the plaintiff. But it is definitely, as companies are sort of coming out of the garage and are maybe have some venture capital but don't have so much money that they can really stand on principle, they might become targets where a plaintiff thinks they're going to be able to get a quick settlement so that the defendant can get on with their business, as the defendant, I'm sure, would like to do.
In your paper, you mentioned some other industries that might be affected. Can you maybe expand on besides they'd be industries now that you don't think of as being virtual reality or augmented reality businesses, but probably pretty soon are going to be.
Right. So one of the things, this article was based on, the firm did a survey of AR and VR people and in the industry, and this is actually our second such survey. We just released the third survey, and what we found in all of these surveys is the wide variety of applications that people think AR and VR is going to be applied to. There are some that spring to mind pretty quickly. So gaming is obviously a big one people expect, and there's already a lot of virtual reality and augmented reality games out there. But there are also a lot of other industries that we think will be impacted by AR and VR. So education being one, healthcare, there are apps that allow you to sort of do virtual surgery that help doctors train to do certain kinds of surgery. And real estate is another big one where real estate agents are able to sort of do virtual home tours and that sort of thing. And so the impact of AR and VR, especially with things like smartphone augmented reality, which is available on pretty much any modern smartphone these days, it seems like it's going to have a really big impact, which broadens in one way it's great that, you know, these technologies are going to really have a big impact in a lot of areas. The issue is, as these industries start using AR and VR more commonly, they could become targets for NPEs.
It sounds a little bit like the joke about why bank robbers rob banks is because that's where the money is.
And exactly.
That's where the money is going to be going, to these industry sectors. So
I think that's right.
Your paper gives some advice on what to do if you're sued by an NPE. Could you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, so the first thing that you should do if you've been sued by an NPE is to review your underlying contracts with your software supplier or vendor and see if you have an indemnification clause that might indemnify you or cover the cost of litigation. So the most common indemnified claim is an IP infringement claim against a customer, and this is because customers are at risk of patent claims or lawsuits just by using the vendor's technology. So with the indemnification provision, the vendor can promise to protect the customer against such a claim. So generally, these provisions will require the vendor to bear the costs, including legal fees, of defending you, the customer, from any claim that the vendor's products or services infringe the patent rights of a third party. So the idea is to shift the risk to the party that can better assess and deal with it. And ideally, that's the, you know, software supplier whose technology you're using. So these clauses will vary from contract to contract, but because they expose the supplier to a significant risk, they might place monetary caps on the amount of damages that you can collect. But overall, this could be a great way to avoid the cost and burden of having to litigate against the NPE yourself. So that's the first step. The second strategy would be to consider bringing an early motion to dismiss, which we kind of alluded to earlier. And this would be based on the grounds that the NPE's patent doesn't actually cover patentable subject matter, and that, in fact, it's directed to non-patentable laws of nature, natural phenomena, or abstract ideas. So ever since the Supreme Court's decision in Alice Corr v. CLS Bank in 2014, these types of motions have been on the rise. So in this decision, the court clearly codified a two-step test in applying the Section 101 exception. And the test means that courts have to, one, determine whether the claims at issue are directed to one of the patent-ineligible concepts, and two, which is really where courts and parties have struggled, is that the courts need to determine whether the claims contain an inventive concept sufficient to transform the nature of the claim into a patent-eligible application. So the issue there has been figuring out what does it mean to be an inventive concept, and what does it mean to transform the nature of the claim into a patent-eligible application. And the way that these cases have really shaken out since Alice is that there's been a wave of case law invalidating computer-based patents at the pleading stage. However, recent trends in case law have shown that the success of these Rule 12 motions has actually been on the decline. So right after Alice, the success rate was about 77%, and nowadays it's under 40%. And we found that courts have primarily been rejecting these motions for one of two reasons. So the first is that the courts will reject the motions because they believe that claim construction is necessary to resolve the 101 challenge before rejecting the motion to dismiss. And in other words, the court would basically say that there are too many factual ambiguities in the language of the patent to make such a permanent decision this early in the suit. There's actually a recent Law 360 article from March which discusses this issue specifically in the Central District of California. But generally, if the facts are at issues in your case or if claim construction is pretty problematic, your chances of winning an early motion to dismiss decline at this stage. And then the second reason that we found that courts have primarily rejected Rule 12 motions hinges on the second point in the Alice test, which is that courts will just decide that the defendant has failed to meet its burden on at least one of the two Alice steps. So our white paper discusses some of the leading cases that exemplify these two types of reasons, which are mainly the Berkheimer and Atrix cases. But overall, the lesson is that parties should heavily rely on the factual precedent of those cases in distinguishing or analogizing their cases when they raise these challenges, because courts have really relied upon the language in that precedent in either granting or denying the motions.
So your paper also discusses using joint defense groups among defendants who've been sued by an NPE, which reminds me of the expression, united we stand, divided we fall. Yeah. So how do joint defense groups work and help in an NPE situation?
Yeah, well, as Dave mentioned, NPEs will often attack several similarly situated defendants at the same time. And because these defendants have a common interest in defeating the NPE, forming a joint defense group can be a cost-effective strategy of sharing the burden of defending the lawsuit. So a lot of times you'll collaborate with a joint defense group on issues like discovery and comprehensive case strategy, and that will help kind of share the wealth in preparing for trial and paying for trial. And the joint defense groups are actually particularly helpful for smaller companies where, you know, a joint defense group might be the only economically feasible way that you could entertain litigation against an NPE since you would be sharing the cost. And this isn't to say that joint defense groups are perfect. A lot of times you're dealing with, you know, a lot of cooks in the kitchen, maybe too many cooks in the kitchen, different types of work product quality. So, you know, if you are going to enter into a joint defense group, you should consider setting aside some litigation resources just to actually manage the communication within the joint defense group itself and the strategy within the joint defense group. But overall, especially for AR/VR companies, if they started forming joint defense groups, it can create kind of an industry-wide beneficial reputation so that NPEs will know, oh, we're not just suing, you know, a smaller mom-and-pop company. They might have the strength of a joint defense group behind them.
Yeah, it's funny you phrase it that way because it brings to mind to me a predator attacking a pack of animals. And they usually go for the weak and the weak and the old and the infirmed on the edges. But as soon as the group itself unites in defense, it becomes a lot less interesting for the predator.
Exactly.
So have you got any final advice for a company sued by a non-practicing entity?
Yeah, gather as much intel as you can about these NPEs. As a lot of this case law has shown, they have, you know, specific strategies that they're using, and if you can kind of anticipate that going into litigation, it will help you prepare even more so, and just know what type of NPE that you're dealing with. You know, figure out who else they've sued, what's the litigation history of this NPE, how soon are they settling, if they're settling, and yeah, the more you know, the more informed your strategy will be, and the sooner that you can get back to business with as few interruptions as possible.
David and Danielle, thank you very much for these insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Bacarach-Crone and Danielle Grant Kane are respectively counsel and an associate at Perkins Coie. For further information on Dave and Danielle and their paper entitled The Coming Wave, Preparing for the Rise of Patent Litigation in the Augmented and Virtual Reality Sector, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.